Today's date is September 3rd, 2010. We are at the Amelia Island Museum of History. And the following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Heritage Keepers Project. Today we are interviewing Mrs. Mary Agnes White, who was born Mary Agnes Wolfe on December 7, 1923 in Mobile, Alabama. My name is Marie Santry, and I will interview the subject on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Assisting me is second interviewer Robert Hamer and Bobby Faust, who will operate the recording equipment. I will now begin this interview. Mary Agnes?
Yes,
welcome.
Ma'am.
Welcome. Welcome. I'm good. How about you?
I'm doing fine.
Good. Tell us a little bit about your early life in Mobile, Alabama, and your move to Fernandina.
Well, my father was born in Fernandina a long time ago, in 1891, as a matter of fact, and he always loved it here. But when he finished college, he was a dentist, and he wanted to come back to Fernandina, but there was not room here for another dentist. There were already two practicing. So he ended up doing some other things, and went in government service, and he ended up in the Marine Hospital in Mobile, Alabama, and he was a oral surgeon there, and did a lot of anesthesia too. But as a consequence, I happened to have been born in Mobile and stayed there. Went to grade school and in Mobile in those days, it was only 1 year of junior high. They only had 11 years of school then. And you went to the sixth grade, and then you went to Bartram Academy, and that was 1 year of junior high. And then you went to the 11th grade, and you were a freshman in high school. So I finished at Bartram Academy, and by that time, Dad had arranged to come back. The Mills were coming back to Fernandina at that time. And so he decided, let's go back home. And that's what we did at that time. I enjoyed growing up in Mobile. I remember the Mardi Gras, and I have lots of pictures of costumes, and I was an only child, so they had all the pictures of me. You know, it's the second and third child they were taking pictures of, they tell me. But anyway, we had a good time. I enjoyed growing up. Dad was a wonderful guy, and he should have had six boys. The poor thing only had me, so he took me hunting with him, and we rode horseback together, and he had hunting dogs, and so, and we were very close. My mother and I were too, but I was my daddy's girl, I guess you'd say.
Well, for the record, what was your father and mother's names?
My dad was George Ralph Wolfe. He was the youngest of the four Wolfe boys. And my mother was Rachel Louisa McCree, and she was from Valdosta, Georgia. And they married during in World War One. Okay. He was in both wars, mm-hmm. or served in both wars. He wasn't a troop. He was a medical man.
And what year then was it when your family actually came back to Fernandina?
In 1937. The Mills were coming back then. And by that time, Dr. Lynn was not here anymore. Back when he had wanted to come, Dr. Lynn and Dr. McMurray, I beg your pardon, Dr. Lynn was here. Dr. McMurray had ceased to practice. So there was only one dentist then. So Dad came back and wanted to practice here. And if you'll remember, maybe thinking back from a historical standpoint, in small towns, if you go down the main street and you look up, the building used to be over the drugstore, and it'll have a bay window. And that's usually was a dentist office, because they got the light right. They had the chair sitting in that bay window, and the light was right there for them to be looking the mouths and work on them. Well, our dentist office, as you know, is what's over the coffee shop now, the Dickens Building. It's where the art shops are. Dr. Rodifer had that office for a long, long time. But before that, Dr. Lynn had it. And so that one wasn't available. So Dad went across the street, and it was upstairs. He had the suite of offices over the what was then the old bank building. It's the building catty corner to the the saloon, the palace. Mm-hmm. Okay. No one, and so he had all that upstairs suite up there. And there are lots of funny stories about it. When he was setting up his practice, one day, they in those days, the telephone ladies were upstairs over what is now the jewelry store. Anyway, they had the little machine, and then somebody sat there and plugged in the, you know, the lights went on, and they plugged in and said, central, or, you know, who's number, please, and everything. So apparently they'd gotten all these numbers fixed up ready for it, and they sat down waiting for people to call and make appointments, and nobody called, and they started wondering and looked. Finally, for some reason, they called the telephone lady and said, why don't I get any telephone calls? People at least tried to call and say, hey, and we don't hit you. And she looked around. She said, well, what's your number? Well, it was way down here in the corner, and it was so dusty that the light wasn't showing through. And so they didn't know that their light had come on to say, number, please.
Well, that could put a damper on business.
Yeah. So apparently they really cleaned up the telephone switchboard at that point, and then all the lights came on a lot. But he had a lot of, always wanted to come back, so we had a lot of fun then coming to him.
Well, that would have been, he would have been setting up business at the toward the end of the Depression era, but that still would have been the Depression
era.
Yeah,
it was still pretty hard times here, but with the mills coming, it was very, very well received. The people really needed the jobs. There was very little. As you know, they say that the grass grew up between the bricks and the streets because there just wasn't any activity along the way. And it was down to the really basics. They had the pokey plant people came and went, and they had that industry to an extent. Of course, shrimping, there wasn't that much refrigeration to help with the shrimp at that point. It did help with the ice. But it was pretty bad. It was pretty slow. But it was coming in, and the mills came in. The container came first and then Rainier, I think, but they both came in about the same time, the same year. And our town really prospered from that. Dad became mayor soon after he moved back over here, and the city gave the two mills, what's the word you use when they don't pay taxes for 10 years? Anyway,
a moratorium
or something. Anyway, for them to come and encouragement to come in on this island, and gave them 10 years tax free. So the city with the infrastructure was really hurting at that point. And I know Dad. We had both the chief of police and the fire chief was the same man, Mr. Decker. And Dad said many a time they sat up late trying to figure out how they were going to meet payroll that week, you know, or whatever. But they came through it fine, and once they came on the tax roll, we did very well. It was, as I had told y'all earlier when we were talking, the city of Fernandina at one time, I guess in the 40s, was considered one of the best, what's the words I want for it? The
highest per capita? Is that what you told us?
highest per capita, and go on.
Yeah. Fernandina had the highest per capita income, was one of the highest per capita income cities in the state of Florida. And it was because we had great industry here. We had two mills within the city limits. We had the pokey plant, which was a very active industry every year. It was yearly, and they came and went. But when the fish were in this area, it was very highly, very good. They used to get well, they said, economically, down on Center Street. And then, of course, we had some shrimping and the fishing down on the docks, and then the tourists. We were a big tourist, South Georgia, really pretty much a Georgia beach, they called us, and it was a summertime tourist industry.
Now, was that as early as the Depression era, or
yeah,
did that
people,
happen?
They still, when they opened up the beach, you went to the down Atlantic Avenue or Center Street to Atlantic Avenue to the beach. And to the south, the locals went pretty much and had got that property. And to the north, was we always called it Georgia Beach. And the lots of people from Waycross, more south, like Waycross and some of the southern Georgia cities, but some Atlanta people too came in. And we had lots of Georgia people that came on down regularly.
So it sounds like the end of the Depression was pretty.
The mills coming here really did help us.
That's good.
You said that your father was mayor.
Mm-hmm.
Do you recall what the biggest challenges were to government at that time?
The economy. The fact that they had trouble that first 10 years meeting payroll. And, of course, the infrastructure. They were having to do streets and all of those things that were to build up the town. The water system, sewage system at that point. I think we still had a lot of the sewers emptying into the river, and they had to relocate a lot of that work, too.
You were coming from Mobile, Alabama, and coming to Fernandina. Put yourself back at that time. You were about 14 years old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, as a 14-year-old, you know, what did you think of your first impression of Fernandina coming from Mobile, Alabama?
Well, that really wasn't a first impression because I grew up here in the summers. My grandmother and grandfather were here. And we came back every summer and played on the beaches. It was a wonderful experience. This is a great place to grow up. We had so much fun. And my dad was the youngest of four boys, and they all would come back to grandmother's pretty much and had play toys there, you know, the difference in men and boys, the price of their toys. And the boys all had cars by that time. And the old Fords that they'd get on the beach, we had an old Model A, and it was an open kind of touring car, and it was so light you could literally, two or three men could pick it up. So when it got stuck, you didn't try to get it out, you just picked it up out of those ruts and put it on a harder beach. But we fished and sailed on the beach. You know about sailing, you've been sailing, yep. And have the fish fries right there on the beach. And we just always enjoyed so much that. What we were doing there. When I first came back, your cousin, I guess he's your cousin, Robert Ferreira,
yes.
Was one of the best dancers in my crowd.
Oh, was he?
And so we went to the old casino then. Mm-hmm. You remember used to take people on tour and saying that's where the casino was, and they'd look at me real funny like, they gambled here? Well, no, they didn't gamble. They just danced and had parties out there and all that sort of stuff. And they had a real pretty good dance floor there. And then on the opposite corner was Moore's Corner, we called it. And they had the blue room in the back. Had one blue light, I think, back there. But it didn't matter. That's where we danced. And then later they put in a dance floor. There was one of the best in the Northeast. I mean, in the hotels in Jacksonville, you had a little postage stamp to dance on. But we had Moore's, that floor to dance on. It was great. And we danced, and the Jitterbug was in then and during the war, of course, when I was coming up. We had a good time.
Let's see. Let's step back a little bit. Let's talk about where did you first live when you came to Fernandina?
We had places on the beach. Dad and Uncle Raymond both had gone out very early on, when the beach property belonged to the Coast Guard, and so when they decided to let the people have the property out there, they surveyed it and platted it, and then they let folks were going to put it up at auction. And a lot of people, for instance, my Uncle Raymond, my dad's twin brother, had gone out and had a place on kind of the end of where the local people had sort of settled out there. It was a really high sand dune, beautiful big old high sand dune. And so they used to call it the goat club because they said, people would say, who are all those goats wandering around on top of that sand dune? And it was people. But he liked that so much. So people like Uncle Raymond, the Ferreras, the Corders, all the locals that had gone out and just built shacks out on the beach to enjoy. If you had built property, then it was a gentleman's agreement that they wouldn't bid against you. So when it went up for auction, you got it for the lowest auction price that the government put on it. So that some of that property went very cheap.
So there were places built out there before the property actually became public? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, they went out and sort of squatted on it. It played and had these shacks. They weren't sealed or really good, but it's just something a lean-to for the used to have beach parties and things like that.
Well, how far down Main Beach, or how far down the beach?
You know where the captain's house is now?
Yes.
That was Uncle Raymond's property. That was sort of the end of the locals' property at the time that it went on. Now, the old Strathmore Hotel had been out there, and it had been further in front. That's completely washed away before they had their property, or they built back there.
Right. Okay, so they were that far down. Mm-hmm. So you lived out at the beach during
Dad years? Had three lots north of Uncle Raymond's. Dad had it. It went from the water's edge to Fletcher Avenue, and the road kind of stopped there at Uncle Raymond's place. It was just Shell Road, but it was out there. And so we had a place. He had placed three houses north of that. We built, and that was our summer place, and we came over and stayed there in the summer. So when we moved over here, we went there to live, and I started as a freshman in high school when I went to school, and this Easter Monday of that year, which would be 1938, our house burned up on the beach. And we moved in town and lived with my grandmother and grandfather in the old Wolf House on the corner of Ash and 6th Street until we moved to Dad. At that point, when our house on the beach burned, Dad and Mommy started looking for a place to buy, and they bought the house I live in now at 502 Broome Street on the other side of town, north side of town. And he bought that, but it had the folks that had it had a lease on it with the folks that lived in it. And places were hard to find then because all this influx of people were coming in from the mills. So there wasn't that much.
For a second then.
Well, tell us a little bit more about the house that your father bought.
502 Broome Street. The one that Dad bought when it had been built in the 1880s. By a lady named Mary B. Waz, and she her husband was a cousin of the Waz family that's here now, but she and he had moved to town, and she decided to buy and build a house on this property, and that when she went to the courthouse or wherever she had to go to get permission to do this, she had to sign a paper that she was neither beaten nor coerced into doing this, because so few women did that type of thing on their own at that point in time. So she built the house. This couple eventually divorced, which was unusual too, and went their separate ways. She sold the house. It was known as the Little House. It was just four rooms with the kitchen off the back, like they had the bathroom in the backyard. And so she sold it, and it changed hands along the way. When my dad was a little boy, the snowstorm of 1890, he remembered from that house. Grandpa and grandmother had rented it. They never owned it, but they rented it, and Dad remembered, because later, when we had a later snowstorm, he said, you know, Shelton, the first one that I, the first time I remember seeing snow was from this house in 1890 when I was a little boy. So he had always liked that house. So when came time, he looked it up again and decided to buy it. And it had been a rental. Well, the McClellans lived there for a long time and grew up. He'd worked with the Pogey plant and raised his family there, but he never owned it, so there was a long time that they lived in that house. And then later, it was a rental property, and that's when these people had come in and rented it, that had a lease for a year. And then once they left, they were building their place on the beach at that time, so then when they moved out of the house, Dad renovated it, did a lot of work on it before we moved in. And we stayed at my grandmother's at that point. And that was a fun place to live, too, that big old house on the corner of Ash and 6th Street. Yeah. Is the Wolf House. And that's back in the family again, which is very interesting.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Grandpa and Uncle Raymond sold it the 80s, I guess, the 70s. Miss Dees lived there for years and years and years. And then when her family decided to sell it, we were downtown one day, ran into this lady, and Aggie was talking, she's my daughter, was talking to her and said something about Wolf, and the lady said, well, my daughter-in-law is a Wolf. It turned out she's a cousin, and George Wolf's daughter. Her sister, Druzy, who lived in California, had made a great deal of money in early disc with Apple or something, and she cashed in her chips and had lots of money. And so they called Druzy and said, the old Wolf House is for sale. And Druzy bought the house, flew over here, saw it, bought it, renovated it. It's completely, it's been on the tour of homes, you know, and redid it, and it's their beach house now. So I think it's interesting that old Wolf House. However, the old Wolf House was not originally built by the Wolves either. They bought it, and the gentleman that had built it, I don't remember his name off the top of my head, but he had three daughters. So in those days, every daughter courted at home. And so there are three Paulas in that house. So each daughter had her own Paula to court in. So it was a funny, big, old, great house. So that's the old Wolf House that we like. And that's where my dad grew up, in that house.
Well, let's talk about school. You mentioned going to school here. Where did you go to school?
The big brick place across from Central Park on Atlantic Avenue. Not the old red big brick building. Dad graduated there, but I went to the other school. And all 12 classes, 12 grades were in that school. They didn't have kindergarten then. But the grammar grades were downstairs, and the high school was upstairs.
Now, that you're talking about what most recently was Atlantic Elementary School?
No, the big building where the school offices are now.
Oh.
That was
okay.
The big new high school when I started.
Right. That's sort of behind or to the side
of
that
back,
school.
It's way back and has all the pretty trees in front of it.
Yes.
That's where I went to school.
Okay.
And graduated.
How did you get there?
Walked.
You walked?
Of course you walked. Walk to school in those days. That wasn't any trouble to walk from my house particularly.
Yeah.
But we had 24 in my class, which was unusual. It was a big class. And there were 12 boys and 12 girls, which again was very unusual. And we had a lot of our class that went on to college. And of course, we graduated in 41 and unrest in the country, and then about that time was when the war started, World War II started, so a lot of them were going off to service and things like that.
Do you stay in touch with any of them now? Do you go to reunions or anything?
Do
you stay in touch with them now? Anybody from the class?
We did reunions. They did them at my house most of the time.
Okay.
But we had a lot of fun and kept up, and Donald Struss is still alive. His grandmother was Kate Bailey, and she wrote the class song. And wrote the alma mater that they use now. But in those days, she wrote a song for each class. And so she wrote the song for our class, and we were the last one because Dawn was her youngest grandchild. And so she wrote us a song, and then she wrote the alma mater that they use now. But let's see, Dawn and Frances Stewart Allen, she used to live on the hill, was in my class, and she us here from her. Joan McAlevey, Herbst, but she went to the convent. Now, the convent was open in those days for school, too, and there were four of them, Billy didn't graduate that class, Robert Green, and the McAlevey or the Kelly girl, and Mildred Corder were the ones that graduated at the same time we did. And so we all just coupled our parties and everything together because there were only four graduates up there. But that we went around together as a group, as a crowd.
Do you recall if St. Michael's was also a school at the time? Was St. Michael's?
That's what I'm talking about.
Right.
When I say the convent, we just called it the convent then.
I think it was St. Joseph's Academy. Was it still called St. Joseph's Academy?
And the nuns were there. Right. And we had sisters that ran it completely, and Sister Josephine was there, and she taught music, and Sister Noli taught music. A lot of the group, my age group, all took music there, whether they went to the Catholic school or not.
Mm-hmm.
If they went to public school, they went to the sisters to teach for music. And it was always so active. And Father Halligan was with us in those years. He's the most wonderful priest that ever was. We all love Father Halligan. When they came to bury him, they brought him back here to bury him. And the brother that brought him back said he'd never seen so many non-Catholics in a Catholic funeral. Everybody loved Father Halligan.
Yeah. Well, what was your favorite subject?
Oh. Well, I didn't mind school. We got along fine. I don't know, Clyde Russell was a favorite teacher, I guess. Everybody loved her, and she taught us English. And then, of course, Frieda Bennett was notoriously good teacher. She was cited as one of the best teachers in Florida at one time. She was a math teacher. And Miss Bennett, was a Georgia girl, and she came down here, and old Georgia, she rooted for Georgia. One time she couldn't get tickets at the Georgia-Florida game anywhere but in the middle of the Florida cheering section, and she sat there and rooted for Georgia and nearly got killed. But we all love Frieda, and she everybody hunted marsh hen in those days, all the boys did, and they'd go out, and if the tide was right, then they'd go hunting in the morning and skip school. And nobody, teachers didn't mind if they shared some marsh hen with them, particularly Miss Frieda, and so she didn't count them as absent if they brought us a marsh hen. But she was so funny. But she was excellent. And when we went to college, we were very blessed to have had Frieda and Clyde. And John Wiester was our chemistry teacher that year, and some other folks we had that were very good teachers. And we did. I know I went to Wesley in my freshman year, and I didn't even have to take took the test, but I didn't have to take those freshman math courses or English courses to brush you up for college, because we really had excellent teaching in our school. Because Frieda and Clyde, I think, led the pack, but they were so good, both of them.
Excellent. Well, was the class structured with the back then like it is today? Did you move from class to class, or did your teachers come to you?
Yeah, pretty much. Different from English. We had English, math. We had I took Spanish in high school. Actually, Clyde taught us Latin too in high school. We had chemistry, biology. John Wiester was teaching chemistry and biology. Coach Cruz was the coach. We didn't have football. We only had basketball. But basketball was very big around the county. None of them really had big. Well, they didn't have football teams then. But we traveled on school buses from school to school for the ball games, and that was our big excitement for sports. We had a good time with that.
Good. Well, after the school let out for the day, what did you guys do?
Went home to eat some. But we'd go do whatever. We'd go to the beach, walk down the docks. I don't know. Let's see. The movie in those days was where across the street from the Methodist Church, where that shop is. And it was the old Ritz that I remember. There was one that previous to that was down on Center Street. And I don't know, further downtown, near where the Irish shop, I think now is about where the oil's in the next block. But that was the first movie. But then we'd go to the movies. Of course, we went a lot on Saturday, and you saw the ones that ran from the cereals. That ran from week to week, you know, and all those. And of course, my mother used to call them the bookie book bang bangs, the cowboy pictures we went to see, and all the good old time stuff. So we had fun with the movies. And when you went on dates, you went on the movies. And then eventually Ed Beach built the movie where the Just across the street from the water tower area out there. We had a Quonset hut. He had a big old Quonset hut that he put up that was the movie house then. And that was a movie place for a long time.
When you were in high school and you went down to Main Beach, what would you see down at Main Beach? Was there a pier down there? Or was there
an arcade? No, when you got to the crossroads now where that big condo has been built on the water side, that was Moore's Corner, as we called it. And Ms. Moore, he was Syrian. And I don't know where he was born, but I only remember Mr. Moore's being here. Ms. Moore was from St. Mary's, and they married and had a big family. Ms. Moore was asthmatic, and she couldn't even go to town. The beach was her salvation, and if she lived out there, then she never did have asthma attacks. So they were early, early permanent residents at the beach. And they had the house out there, and so he was a barber. He did a little, had a barber shop, and then got into groceries. And particularly with the summertime, the boys had an old beat up truck, and they'd take the ice to the people that were out there to put in the ice boxes, because particularly the summer people, visitors, or even the people that lived out there. But became a grocery store.
Okay.
And then not his oldest son, but one of the older boys, Ed, had the big grocery store that we all remembered as we grew up. And they had the grocery store, and then he had a bar. Next bar was a bar. And then what we call the old blue room was in the back, and the kids went out there and we danced. And I know some of the mothers would fret, you know, our religious mothers would fret about people going out and dancing at Moore's Corner. And I know Bill Dunkel was a Methodist minister. I'm Methodist. And one day he heard so much about this, so he put on his clerical collar one Saturday night and went out to the blue room to see what was going on. We were all out there dancing. And he came back and told the ladies of the Methodist church that they did not need to worry about sending their children to Moore's Corner to dance. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Moore was out there chaperoning, and he looked after them, and it was fine.
Good.
Yeah. We had Mr. Dunkel's permission, the Methodist did, to go out and be at Moore's Corner.
Were the roads paved, or were they mainly dirt roads at that time?
You had shale roads pretty much around town. But they paved the Atlantic Avenue by then, all the way out to the beach. And you went out, and then Fletcher went both ways, as I had said earlier. The Fletcher went to where Raymond's place was, and then it went kind of about out to Saddle Road, and then it went on down and stopped until World War II. Oh, two little houses down there, another mile or so down around the surf somewhere. And that's as far as it went. And then when World War II came along, the city negotiated with the Navy, or the Navy with the city. The two of them got together and put in the airport. And when they did that, they had closed off the road, the Amelia Road, to put that airport in. They had to build a new road around the airport to go to the south end of the island. So at first they opened up the road, all the way down to where it hit the Amelia Road when they were going to put the airport in.
Right.
And then they did the airport, then they built the road around. So then we had two ways to go all the way down to Amelia.
Was American Beach an active beach at this time?
No, American Beach started in the, in the 40s.
Okay.
Mr. Askins sold the property to the folks that bought it, the band that started it had the insurance company in Jacksonville.
Yeah, A.L. Lewis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they started, and of course the town didn't really want it. It was way down there, and it didn't matter. I mean, it wasn't close or anything, and you had to go down. Now, a lot of that was shell road down in the south end, or dirt roads down that way. But you got that far, and so then after folks did not want them to go any further north and south, so they went east and west and went on back to the road. They built in the hammock, is built in that area a lot in there. Because later when Bob and I were in the lumber business, we had a lot of customers who had places at American Beach. A lot of doctors and lawyers from the Washington and Virginia area and places like that.
So there was no southern exit off the island at that time?
No,
it's just the main one in the north.
If anybody ever did anything bad, the policeman called the Bridgeton and said, open the bridge, don't let anybody off. And unless they had arranged to fly off or had a boat, they were stranded on the island until they got caught.
Well, you mentioned World War II a little bit. You were about 18 years old when Pearl Harbor was bombed.
Mm-hmm.
You remember how you found out about that?
Suzanne Hardy was, or Suzanne Davis, she was one of my best friends, and she was a year ahead of me at school, and she'd gone to Wesleyan, and she was had gone up for the weekend to visit her at Wesleyan, and I was up there.
Oh.
And we were all trying to think of what had happened. We just couldn't believe it. It was just we just weren't expecting it.
Yeah.
Those, I'm sure, the politics or some folks were, but at our level, we weren't really thinking in those terms. Although, we'd known about unrest and it was coming, but we were teenagers. You didn't pay that much attention to that then.
Yeah.
What was life like here on the island during World War II? Did it change much?
I don't know that you'd say it changed. They had blackout. When you got to the hill, going to the beach, you turned off your car lights and drove by hope and God to get out there. They had blackout curtains all across. Once in a while, we'd have a lot of oil on the beach when tankers or something of that nature were sunk out there. We had I was an airplane spotter. We had the airplane spotting out there. We had Coast Guard here. That was interesting. They had a horse patrol, you know, that patrolled the beach. Oh, and they had bonds at the fort and south end of the island.
Hmm.
And so we had most of the young men that we met at that point, that we had the USO for, we were Coast Guard a lot, because that was what we had stationed here.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Jacksonville had an awful lot of Navy and all of that over there, so we had people coming and going. Oh, and then Fort Stewart. Yeah, Fort Stewart in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
They bivouacked on North Beach on two or three occasions. Okay. We'd had a lot of soldiers, army in town at that point.
What about Kings Bay? Was that a submarine base at that time? No,
no, it was not in St. Mary's at that time. That's come since then.
Sure.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Would you tell us a little bit about college? You have mentioned that you went to Wesleyan.
I went to Wesleyan my freshman year. Really, with Suzanne's influence, I was enjoying going up, and I had been up as a senior, too. And I had a great freshman year up there. However, my grandmother lived in Valdosta, Georgia, and that was GSCW. One's Georgia College for Women, and the other's Georgia Women's College. Anyway, I went to the one in Valdosta. And I graduated there from that college and went on over, because grandmother just lived two blocks over. And I had an aunt that went in the WAC, and at that point she had a new Pontiac sports car, and she didn't take it off when she went off to go in service and left it in the garage. And I think that might have had something to do with my transfer, because grandmother didn't drive. And I couldn't have a car at college, but I could go over and drive it, because grandmother and the dean were real good friends. So Miss Hopper didn't care what I did, so I went over and took grandmother's grocery shopping and stuff, and then so I had access to a car from then on in school. But so I went over to Valdosta and graduated.
Did you get an arts degree, or did you do a general education program or something?
I have
specific?
A degree, a double major in chemistry and speech, of all things.
Really?
And a minor in biology. I love the chemistry teacher, Dr. Phelan, and I were great friends. And I just enjoyed chemistry, and I later went to New York and did research chemistry at Brooklyn Polytech for a year after I got out of college.
Wow.
I was working on chlorophyll.
Oh. very impressive
at that point. It was fun. I had a lot of fun going up there. My roommate in college, and I went up. She was the model type, and I was always fat and chubby, and so I did chemistry. But I had a ball. We had a great time. And when I went up, I advertised in the New York Times, and Mr. Venerable saw my ad and called me, and he said, "You're a chemist?" And I said, "I sure am. I didn't know nothing about doing anything like that." And he had a place in Mexico, and they were making hemp rope, actually, and they were putting a lot of chemicals in it and weren't able to get the chlorophyll out. And chlorophyll was just coming into its own with great enthusiasm. And so we were trying to figure out how they were messing it up with the chemicals. And somebody in Germany, a man named Wilstead, had done this, and I was researching his work. And we went back, and he worked on spinach. At one part, they laughed and said I had cornered the market on spinach in Brooklyn because I bought so much spinach to bring up to my lab to work on. But we had a lot of fun working on it, and later Mr. Venable came up and built a plant in New Jersey. I had a ruptured appendix about a year into my work, and they didn't know what it was, and I had a bad time, and Dad came up and brought me home. And so I didn't go back. But
so that ended your career in chemistry.
Well, then I went in the Red Cross, and that's when I went to Europe.
I want to talk to you about the Red Cross, but before we do that, at the break you shared another story about
Frieda Bennett.
Bennett.
Miss Frieda was our math teacher that we all just adored. And you were saying, what did we do after school? A lot of times, her husband worked for Watts' drugstore, which was on the corner across from where the post office is now, was where it was then. And J.C. was down there and worked the night shift a lot. Also, the boys hopped the curb in those days. You'd go up and drive up and park in front of the drugstore and toot the horn, and one of the guys at work came out and took your order. And he'd go in and get a Coke or whatever you'd ordered and bring it out and put it on a tray on the side of the car. And so a lot of the high school kids had that job too. But J.C. was down at the store at night a lot. So Frieda would be down there with him. They didn't have any children. And so we'd all go down to the drugstore to do our homework, because Frieda'd help us if we'd all come down there. So, and they had these beautiful, they're antiques now, with their round marble tables, and and the benches swung on them. Have you seen those?
Yeah.
Where they came out with the little swing? So they had about four or five of those down there, and we used to do our homework at the drugstore. Waz's drugstore with Frieda helping us. And that was the kind of schooling we had. It was such a hands-on thing. I guess that's why we got along so well.
Well, it was let's talk about your Red Cross experience. Exactly what was that experience, and when did that occur?
I played bingo a lot and danced 1,000 miles. I was in club work. It was not. I wasn't in the medical part. This was
okay.
During the war, the Red Cross. Red Cross called themselves filling emergencies. Or they do. That's their credo, is to fill emergencies. And there was an emergency for the men to be helped or looked after, that type of thing. You remember all the stories you heard during the war about their having coffee in the train stations when they were boarding trains, going places. Those were Red Cross girls that were usually doing that for them. And as time went on, they went into the different places where there were troops, and we had clubs, and we did what we call club work. And we had we played bingo, we had set up music some way, had dances, we had like Coca-Cola, whatever we could get, of the different supplies that we could get for them. And so it was club work that I did.
What year was this? Was this right
after? I graduated.
Like 19 years. Okay, so What year were you in the Red Cross?
I was in Red Cross 47, 48, I think, or 46 and 47, something. In that period, time period. You had to be 23 to go in. They wouldn't take you. They wanted you to be a little bit older and more stable. And a lot of the ladies were much older and had been during the war that they'd been over and in the service, serving coffee and the donut girls. But they also had clubs. They took over a lot of the USO clubs. The Red Cross did. Then, while I was in there, the Army took over the entertainment again, and we went back, and I simply wore the same uniform and changed my patch from Red Cross to USO.
Wow. And where was this that you
were? I was in Germany. I was in northern Germany and in Bad Bodungen and in Regensburg. So, my two stations. But my name was Wolf, as you had pointed out, and when I first went in, my first assignment was to the Wolf's Den. I'm sure they had something to do with my name. And I walked in a club room, and some guy looked up, and he said, "Do you know how to play pinochle?" And I said, "No," and he said, "Sit down and learn." And I sat down, and 8 hours later, I knew how to play pinochle, and I played pinochle for a long time after that. That was the big game. Going game then. I had played bridge when I was going. My friends played bridge. We all like played bridge. In high school, we played bridge.
Oh. Well, how did you end up in Germany? I mean, there were clubs all over the place. Mm-hmm. Why Germany?
I was to go overseas. Some of our group went. They weren't going to Japan then. No, not then. Yeah, they were going to the east too, but not as much. Oh. They were going into Germany pretty much.
Okay, so this was an assignment as opposed to a real choice of location.
Oh yeah, you didn't know for sure where you were going when you signed up, and it was the last. We were in the last class that the Red Cross sent over as club workers.
Okay,